Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When John Steinbeck wrote of Mice and Men in 1937, he had a stage adaptation of the novella clearly in mind. It was produced as a play soon after it was published, and 2 years later, the story of the intelligent, responsible George and his mentally challenged companion Lenny, whose enormous strength proves cruelly fatal, was made into a film. It took more than 30 years for Of Mice and Men to find its voice as an opera.
Some rabbits.
Really, George, eating rabbits? Oh, I'd like the George to like that.
But you can get in no trouble, or I'll never have a house and farm.
Oh, I'll be good, I swear it. I'll be so good, don't worry, George. I'll do nothing bad, I swear it.
That was just a little bit of the opera Of Mice and Men. Carlisle Floyd composed it, and he also wrote the libretto. The first production of the opera took place in Seattle in 1970. Since then, it has developed into a much-loved, much-performed standard for American opera companies. And the childlike, mentally disabled giant Lenny has become a signature role for the venerated tenor Anthony Dean Griffey, who will take the stage Monday, June 8th for the final performance of the 2008 Fort Worth Opera Festival. Both men are here to talk about the production and about how this particular work has shaped their careers. Carlisle, Tony, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Carlisle, you were, what, 10 or 11 when the novel was first published. Do you have any memory at all of being aware of it when it first came out?
No, I really don't. The first I think I was aware of Mice and Men was probably the movie,
mm-hmm.
although I never saw it when it first came out. I saw it much later.
So in 1963, you went back and just sort of picked it up to read.
Yeah, to see if I thought there was an opera in it, because I had two very, very dear friends who were also colleagues who were singers. One of them, Norman Traigle, who was very thin. Just, that's an understatement. He was very lean and... another, Richard Cassilly, who was a Heldon tenor, who was very large, and they were both remarkable singer actors, and I had thought it would be wonderful to do something for both of them, and so I reread it with that in mind. As it turned out, neither one of them ever performed it, but that was brewing in my head when I went to San Francisco in 64, I suppose, to stage my opera Susanna for the San Francisco Opera. And the general director of the San Francisco Opera, Kurt Adler, said he would like to talk to me about commissioning a new opera from me. And when I went into his office, he said, we would like to do this and would prefer, if possible, that it be something of Steinbeck. And I said, that's very interesting because I've been thinking about doing Of Mice and Men. He said, Of Mice and Men, that's the only one we never even considered. So it really was almost that easy to begin it, because once with the impetus of a commission, I really did take the project very seriously after that.
Mm-hmm. Tony, the role of Lenny is one that's sort of universally associated with you now. This is one that when people think about it, they think about your singing. What makes the character worth reprising from one production to the next for you?
Well, I so much believe in the character of Lenny. I worked 7 years with special needs children and adults. So I really owe Carlisle so much. I started my career basically with Carlisle when I did my first Met audition. I sang his aria from Susanna, It Must Make the Good Lord Sad. And I did a scene at the Eastman School of Music where I was working on my master's from Of Mice and Men. And the opera director said, one day you'll sing this role. And it's normally associated with tenors with much larger voice than my own. I mean, I've made it work for me. But I think it's important that that Lenny is a living, breathing creature, that he's not a caricature of what we think someone that has special needs is. So it was important for me to give a true-to-life interpretation of the character.
The challenges of that have to be incredible because you can't use language in the same way that you would just acting in a stage play.
Right. And you also, I do things vocally that I wouldn't normally do and other things. I mean, I bring a childlike quality to Lenny that I think it's important. It's a child trapped in this enormous man's body. So it's important to have that balance. It's also emotionally quite draining for me. At the end of the evening, I'm really emotionally spent, and people come to me and I'm a bit glazed over, but it's such an important role for me, and it really started my career. I first sang this role 10 years ago at Glimmerglass Opera, and it really put me on the map. I had finished the Metropolitan Opera Young Artist Development Program, but I was the kind of singer that people found it very hard to cast me in some things because of my size and also because of the voice quality. But it was important for me to find my own voice and not be a carbon copy of the great singers of the past. And I think that's what's I took the road less traveled, and it's made all the difference.
Carlisle, you are also the librettist for this work and for a lot of your other works as well. And I think people who know something about how composers and librettists tend to battle back and forth would assume this simplifies the process and somehow you don't have to worry about that because you're capable of doing both. I'm wondering if it's that simple for you.
Probably, yes. Mm-hmm. I remember the composer Douglas Moore, when I first went to New York with my opera Susanna, he was a wonderful supporter of mine. He was, of course, the dean of American opera composers in those days. And he said, "Oh, Carlisle, I really envy you. You never have to quarrel with your librettist." and I suppose he's right. But I do both, but do them very separately. And it was never that big a stretch for me because I was in creative writing all during college, so I wrote constantly. And as a matter of fact, my first one-act play was an adaptation of a short story I had done in a seminar. I think for better or worse, perhaps coming from one mind and one vision is an advantage. People ask me now, "Well, would you be willing to work with another librettist?" And my standard answer has been, "I'm afraid I'd be too cranky, because I've been doing it so long, and it's really a discipline. It's a very, I think, unacknowledged discipline. It's not playwriting, or it's just not setting a play to music. It's something very specific, and there are very specific parameters and involved in doing it. And it takes a lot of time and experience to learn that, and I think nothing I can imagine would make me more irritable than working librettist and feeling that I had to teach him
what you needed.
What I needed. Mm-hmm. Working with young composers, I've always had them do their own libretto first. Mm-hmm. Not that they become librettists, but they know what to require of a librettist.
There's such a particular...
Excuse me, I want to say one thing while it's still on my mind with mm-hmm. what Lenny here was saying. The thing about Tony that's unique in this role is the fact that when I first faced the prospect of putting Lenny in an opera, the first thought I had is, what do I do with a cipher? You know, what kind of music mm-hmm. to write for them? Because as you see in many productions of Mice and Men, which always bothers me a great deal, he's characterized as kind of a slack-jawed idiot, which is not to me the character at all. And the thing that finally, I reread the novel and finally gave me the key I needed was George always says, "Well, he's just a big kid." Mm-hmm. And I thought, I can do that. You know, I don't want music I can write for a cipher, but I can write for a child or as a child. And, of course, as Tony said, there may have been bigger voices than his having done it. But none has really brought together that sweet childlike lyric quality that Tony has in such abundance to himself as a physical creature. And that's why, as I said, that has made his performance unique.
Well, that approach to Lenny as a child, as opposed to just someone who is really defined by the disability, allows you to have a lot more empathy for Lenny than sometimes you do if he just comes across as sort of a brute who means well, but causes problems for people.
Well, you have to know right from the beginning. I felt that my job was to have the audience find out why George stayed with him, why George cared about him. And I felt that was my job in the first scene, was to establish Lenny as a lovable, guileless creature, which he is. And so, therefore, he has now he has in the first scene an aria that has come to be known as the mouse aria, which is George is asking him, what does he want of a dead mouse? And he talks about his loving of soft things. Mm-hmm. And I feel that after that, you have a very different understanding of why George travels with him, and that he's become such a part of George's life.
Tony, do you play to a different George just about every time you do the role?
You know, as a performer, I've always viewed myself as an actor who sings and a singer who acts. So it's each evening I go into the theater, it's a bit of a different experience for me. I think that it's important to always keep it fresh. So I never get tired of playing Lenny. I'm known for the role, I guess, but I've done seven different productions, but that's in comparison to women who sing Butterfly, 500 times, or Carmen, and it's not a lot of performances. But each evening I go into the theater, I think I bring something new and different each time. It's like when George speaks to me, it's like I've heard the lines for the very first time. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important as an actor to keep it fresh, because the audience always knows.
Well, that's really interesting, because one might assume that each time that you're cast and put into this role, it's because someone has loved the work you've done in it before. But in fact, it sounds like you go into every production open to whatever the director really wants.
Exactly. I think that's important as an artist, to come with an open mind.
Carlisle, I don't know how many of the productions you've seen of Mice and Men over the years. I have to imagine some of them have delighted you and others have disgusted you.
Yes, I was trying to think of those that have disgusted me.
You don't have to name names, exactly.
I definitely won't do that. But in most cases, it's the Lenny who doesn't work in the production, because I think a lot of tenors want to do this role. At least that's been my experience. I remember that from after the Seattle first, the opening in Seattle, there was a tenor there who wanted very much to do it, and he was determined to do it, and he did it. And he wanted to do it very, very badly, but he was simply never credible in the role. I never believed him for a minute. He was a rather high-keyed, wired young man, and he could never bring his own personality down to what Lenny is. Lenny is... basically, his reactions are slow. I mean, they have to be. And it is a curious thing, because I can be sitting in the audience talking to Tony, and he gets on stage, and he's no longer Tony. He's Lenny. And that happens to me really with the first tenor who did the role, even in a sense more markedly, because he was a big, hulking fullback. I mean, he was given a pro football scholarship, but he had the same childlike quality that Tony can suggest so quickly. So I've been fortunate that I haven't seen as many productions that disturb me of Mice and Men as I have of Susanna. But then it's been around a lot longer too.
Composer Carlisle Floyd and tenor Anthony Dean Griffey are with us. We're talking about Of Mice and Men, which will close out this year's Fort Worth Opera Festival June 8th at the Bass Performance Hall. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are talking today about the Fort Worth Opera's performance of Mice and Men, June 8th at Bass Performance Hall. I think I said earlier that it was Monday. It, in fact, takes place on Sunday. So don't show up Monday at 2 o'clock because the place will be shuttered. Carlisle Floyd is here. He's the composer and librettist for that opera. And Anthony Dean Griffey is the tenor who plays Lenny. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. An email from Nicole in Dallas asks, which comes first, the music or the words?
Oh, the libretto, with me. Mm-hmm. That's a separate process that I usually nowadays spend about 18 months on the libretto. And I would say probably that it takes even longer than for the writing of the music. But the music and the orchestration take another 18 months or thereabouts.
And how do you edit? Do you sit down with everything written, or do you listen to a recording of what you've done so far?
You mean for the writing of it?
For any part of it.
No, I usually work from an outline. I mean, for the libretto, at mm-hmm. least. I certainly did in the case of Mice and Men. I had to really ultimately, because I had done an unsuccessful first version, and I had to just toss it out and start over. And I really had to get down to what this opera is about. And it finally came to me after rereading. No, I didn't reread the opera. I never reread the novel, but I really thought, what is it about? And basically it comes down to, as a premise, to George's efforts to keep Lenny out of trouble for them long enough to achieve this very modest dream that they have. And so the opera becomes a suspense story. So it's pretty evident from the very beginning that their dream is probably not going to be fulfilled. But it's a series of roadblocks almost until the final one, which is the murder of Curly's wife.
That was from Of Mice and Men, the opera that will be performed June 8th at Bass Performance Hall. The tenor that you heard there was Anthony Dean Griffey, who is with us this afternoon, also composer Carlisle Floyd. That's a scene that sort of immediately precedes the murder of Curly's wife. Tony, I'm wondering, in the more dramatic moments, and you mentioned this before, that after a performance you're pretty much drained, does working on something like this affect the way you process emotions in your regular life during the time that a performance is going on?
It does a bit. I sometimes go home after rehearsals and watch cartoons.
I want to hug him and squeeze him and call him George cartoon.
Right. No. But I've the roles that I I feel like I'm a bit of a missionary in some ways, because I think these roles are important, but I think that I've taken it upon myself to you know, do these roles because I feel a connection to them, and I feel it's important to give, you know, a real-life interpretation to these characters. And I think that's what touches the audience. You know, so many people that have never been to the opera have been to Of Mice and Men and said, you know, it was their first opera experience, and they didn't realize this is what opera was all about. You know, they have this stereotype. It's, you know, Viking helmets and foreign language, and they won't understand it. But this is a story and music that they can relate with, and they do. They leave the theater moved and touched, and it's a very simple, you know, dream that Lenny and George have, and it's, you know, to own their own home. I think that's the American dream, and it's the reason why it's so important for me. And I don't take every production that I do of Mice and Men, and all the roles that I take on are very important to me as an artist. I don't take on things that I don't think that I can bring something to the character.
It's interesting that you use the word missionary, because I know that you started out, you were going to be a church music director.
Yes, my undergraduate degree was in church music.
How did you evolve into opera?
I was quite shy growing up, painfully shy.
It's hard to believe given what you do for a living.
Right. You know, but it's different. You know, when I'm singing in front of thousands of people, it's, you know, I started to sing because it was what I couldn't say. I didn't feel like I could say. So I have, you know, these great composers and these great librettists that have written this, you know, wonderful music. And it's always what I wanted to say as a person. I started as my undergraduate degree was in church music, and I had planned on going to seminary. But I always loved performing, but I didn't think I had what it took to perform. And it took me from Wingate University in North Carolina. I went to the Eastman School of Music and then to Juilliard, and then I was accepted into the Met Young Artist Program. But as a singer, I had to find my own path and my own direction and find roles that fit me. And when I went in to an audition, I probably did a total of 5 auditions in my career. I was very fortunate. But when I went in and tried to be something that I wasn't, I didn't get the audition. But when I went in as Tony Griffey, I got the audition. So it's important as young singers and as artists, you know, not to be a carbon copy of these great artists of the past. That's what made them great, was their individuality. And, you know, it carries on into your personal life. You know, it's important to be yourself and to realize that no one, you know, there's not another person on the face of the earth like you. We're all individuals, and to, you know, to realize and to be thankful for our own individuality.
Excuse me, I wanted to give a little coda to that. I had a birthday card for a good friend with a quotation from Oscar Wilde that I never heard before. It says, "Be yourself. Everybody else is taken," which I thought was marvelous.
Well, Carla, you also grew up in the church. You're what they call a preacher's kid. Is that right?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Was that an influence on who you became as an artist?
I suppose in some ways it was, because I think if you grew up I was not brought up in an evangelical home, but nevertheless it was a Protestant home, and so there are a lot of strictures, and there are a lot of things that one finds, that one questions growing up, and so it's a very authoritarian atmosphere, which I very much, I think, inwardly rebelled against, and I think, as Tony was saying about himself, I think that was very much the impetus for my trying to become an artist. I mean, it's a way of having your cake and eating it too.
Saying things you couldn't say.
Well, yes, exactly, as Tony very eloquently put it. But it is an avenue for really real self-expression that somehow you don't feel entirely safe revealing personally for whatever reason.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Composer Carlisle Floyd and tenor Anthony Dean Griffey are my guests. The Of Mice and Men performance at the Bast Performance Hall takes place June 8th. It's the last performance of the Fort Worth Opera Festival for 2008. Let's go to Keller and talk to Don. Hi, Don.
Hi. Just let me turn off my speakerphone. Are you there now?
Thank you. Yes, we're still here.
Yeah. Many years ago, 1975, really, I was actually had a small role in Bilby's Doll. And I guess I'm waiting for a reaction from Carlisle. But my question was, is that production, is that show, that opera going to be produced? Has it been recently, or is it going to be anywhere in this area in the near future?
The answer, regrettably, is no. It's one of my personal favorites of my operas, and I have a performing version now that has been the result of a university production in which I was given the opportunity to get it in publishing form. And so it's ready to go. Now all I need is a producing company, because I think it's probably as interesting a libretto as I've ever tackled. And I'm very, very fond of it, and I'm glad. Were you in the Houston production?
We don't have him on the line anymore.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
The Houston production was in 76, and there was a production subsequently, and then it was given an award someplace, a theater group in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, that it's a theater guild or something like that. But it's, as I said, it's waiting for a revival, and a real revival.
We should talk about this for a minute, because there are a number of challenges at different steps for new operas. The first is that you just get it produced that first time. Apparently, this is even for someone who is established and popular with his work, it's not a given that even you, Carlisle Floyd, will get something produced after you've created it.
Not at all. I think the easiest thing to get is the first production.
Mm-hmm.
It's the subsequent productions that are the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been probably as fortunate or more fortunate than anybody else in this respect. So therefore, I can complain about the operas of mine who don't get as many performances of Mice and Men and Susanna or Cold Sassy Tree now. But because in your mind, they're just as worthy of being performed. But audiences' response are curious things. But, of course, it's an enormous incentive for opera companies to do the first performance because of the publicity that surrounds a premiere of a new work. And that's very hard to duplicate later. It's something we haven't really found a way to correct in this country. Although I know Opera America has a whole program, or at least did, devoted to second and third productions. Because in the case of Bilby's Doll, the opera this man referred to, after its premiere, for instance, the new version is probably 30 minutes shorter. So it's a very different opera, and I rewrote substantially much of the third act. And if you do a commission, about all you can do in the initial rehearsal period is to trim. You can't recompose, because that involves orchestration and as well as your own writing. But that's the most you can hope for, and you expect to do a certain amount of that in the rehearsal period leading up to the opening night. But that's not really enough time to assess a new work.
Tony, how critical is the performance of the orchestra to what you're doing?
It's very critical. you're really, I feel, only as good as the conductor and the orchestra mm-hmm. as well. And as a singer that also does a lot of recitals, I'm always, you know, it's very important for the pianist to have good chops as well, because it's a total collaboration. It's not just me that makes Of Mice and Men. It's the whole ensemble. It's the all the cast, the orchestra, and the conductor.
So they all have to take their cues from what you're doing on stage. Is that
well,
right?
We have to take our cues from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's for me as a performer, it's a total collaboration.
And it's worked out in rehearsals. That's where it really happens.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen during performance that much.
Right.
How many rehearsals do you have with a brand new orchestra before you actually go on stage and do a performance of something that you've done before?
Well, for this production, we had about 2.5 weeks. So for me, I enjoy the rehearsal process. That's where I get to therapeutically work out a lot of things. And so there are some artists that enjoy the performing. I do enjoy the performing, but I also enjoy the collaboration and getting to know my cast members and getting to know their characters, because each of them bring, you know, to life their own interpretation of these characters, which, you know, today is so important because we have these wonderful singer actors. Opera is no longer about, you know, standing and singing and planning yourself and, you know, singing the big aria. It's also about being able to act.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's blocking, there's movement, there's, and you're not just moving from one point to the next. You're really acting in this production.
Right.
Mm-hmm. As the famous Peter Hall said, it's not where you move, it's why you move.
Right.
On the stage. And that has everything to do with it. And especially with an opera as difficult, the stages of Mice and Men, because the one difficult scene, which is the most difficult scene I've ever had to stage, is the murder scene.
Mm-hmm. What makes it so difficult?
Because it's inadvertent choking and strangling, and Curly's wife struggling to get free of Lenny, and Lenny not understanding why she's struggling. And in this, not in this particular production, but in most productions, it's all over the stage, mm-hmm. Pretty much, and as it, I think it would be with a, and she also bites him at one point and screams, and this, I know when I always start to stage this, because at the same time they're cues, vocal cues.
Mm-hmm. Musically, it's also quite difficult.
And meanwhile, people are thinking, "Don't injure my soprano," right?
Right.
Oh, it's, but you can't imagine how difficult it is to do short staccato vocal cues in the middle of all this orchestral tempest that's going on.
Right. It's,
and I admire them. And to tell you the truth, I'm never sure of what they're doing musically. Tony's very accurate. Mm-hmm. But there's so much involvement of music and movement at the same time, plus, you know, hysteria on the stage. So it's amazing what people do on the stage that the audience can't really fully appreciate, but certainly as a composer, I do.
Composer Carlisle Floyd and tenor Tony Griffey are with us. We're talking about Of Mice and Men, which will be performed June 8th by the Fort Worth Opera. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Of Mice and Men will close out the 2008 season for the Fort Worth Opera Festival on June 8th at Bass Performance Hall. We have composer and librettist Carlisle Floyd and tenor Anthony Dean Griffey with us to talk about it. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Fort Worth and talk to Gail. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Hi. First of all, I want to express appreciation to both Mr. Floyd and Mr. Griffey for bringing an absolutely magnificent opera to Fort Worth. I would say, run, don't walk to get a ticket. We're going back to see it again. My question is for Mr. Floyd, if I may. I read Of Mice and Men as a youngster, read it again, of course, in college, and then reread it before the opera came. I wonder how Mr. Floyd can decide which scenes or phrases are the most important, how he made such a wonderfully cohesive whole out of really a lengthy book, and also if he was at all intimidated by taking such an iconic work and turning it into an opera.
Thanks for your call, Gail.
Yes, I was not intimidated, but I was lulled into a false sense of security because the novella, you know, is 120 pages. I mean, it's very short. So I thought, okay, my work has been done for me. And when the first version began to approach the length of Gerdamerung, you know, I realized something is wrong. And when my very best friends and even my wife says, it's a bore. I thought that's the, to me, the one thing you cannot do in the theater is bore. And so I started all over after having done the full libretto and about two-thirds of a first draft of the music. And I never went back to the book when I started the libretto the second time. And so it's practically a new opera. Well, with a few exceptions. The Mouse aria I redid. I kept the duet at the end of the first scene. I kept it, re-orchestrated it. But basically, I think I alluded to this earlier. I went... I just had to find out what the book was really saying. And it's a drama about attachment, about human attachment. And one of the things that I thought was interesting, because when Steinbeck was still alive, he saw my first draft of the libretto. I think he would have much preferred the second.
He died 2 years before you actually staged it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the one thing he asked me not to do in the first draft was to make any suggestion of time. I had some references to the Depression in the first draft I did. And I thought he was going to object to my taking out the character of, is it Grooms, I think?
Right.
The one black character. Mm-hmm. And I did that because, number one, it's not the social issue while I was in the 30s. But secondly, I didn't want any there to be another outsider other than Lenny and George on stage. And I think it worked to my advantage not to have that. And he didn't object to that at all.
And you also made changes so that Curly's wife is the only woman on stage.
Yes.
Because you had a scene, you'd written a scene initially.
Oh, I did a scene in a brothel, mm-hmm. which he alludes to in the book, of they're going into town on the weekends, to Susie's, I think it's called. And I thought, well, this will open up the opera. Well, it did, and it's like this, you know, I've had it happen in other operas of mine. The scene as it was, I heard it in the initial New York rehearsals, it worked beautifully. It's a separate scene, but... The question I had to put to myself, or at least that Frank Corsaro and my wife put to me after I made a trip to the bathroom, and they consulted while I was out of the room, and when I came back, I had lost a scene. No, they said, have you thought about not using that scene? And they said, if you can tell the story without it, then you have to really question why include it. So I redid it with that in mind. And also, there's a very strong dramatic contrast to have one woman amidst all these men.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Tony, there's such a particular, in addition to what is going on with your character, with Lenny, there's a particular cadence to the way that Steinbeck writes. I'm wondering if that's in your mind or if your starting place for this role is really what Carlyle has written as opposed to what John Steinbeck has written with the idea for the story.
Can I insert something before he answers? And I don't say this, I hope, immodestly. But I had an English professor friend who did a survey of the libretto, and he said, did you realize that 70% of the dialogue is yours? And I didn't, mm-hmm. to tell you the truth. So now, Tony, you can answer the question.
Well, it was required reading for me when I was in high school in 10th grade, and I fell in love with the novella then. I take it from both aspects, from what Steinbeck has given me and from what Carlyle has given me. And then when I sang at the New York City Opera, Elaine Steinbeck, before her passing, came to the performance, the opening, and wrote me a beautiful note that I have framed in my living room at home.
I didn't know that, Tony.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she said that she just wished that John Steinbeck could have seen me perform this role. It's also a dream of mine. I'd love to do the play because I really enjoy both aspects, the singing and the acting. So this opera combines my love of both. And it also... I feel that opera is meant for all people, not just a select few. And this is an opera for the masses, not just, you know, a select few.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I've wondered this for years. I'm so glad to be able to ask this. How do you know whether a story, whether it's from a novel or a book or a film, how do you know whether it makes a good opera as opposed to, say, a musical? And I ask this because my father's been in the Dallas Opera Orchestra for 23 years, and I've seen every single performance. So I've seen a lot of opera, and I've wondered this. I mean, could you make, an opera out of Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction or something like that? and I've wondered this for years. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
In 25 words or less, huh? No, this is the most difficult aspect of libretto writing, is to determine what will work on the stage as an opera and what won't. And I would say to really try to reduce it to the irreducible, the two things you look for are action and very strong emotion, because it's basically you have to objectify everything through what you see. Puccini is credited with having said that good libretto means that a deaf person can understand it. Because of what it does in terms of mime on the stage, what it requires. Anything that requires great discussion, very philosophical discourse, long intellectual arguments are absolutely to be banished from a libretto. So you have to start out with very, very restrictive credentials in mind. And that's where most new operas go off the rails, frankly, is with the libretto.
Tony, what's your routine on a performance day?
I try to keep my life as normal as possible.
Which means?
And that involves that I talk to my family in North Carolina, and I talk to my nephews maybe. And I don't really have a special routine. I think it's important. I learned a while back that, you know, I'm a singer who's also a person, but I don't – my – I'm not a singer 24/7, but I don't take my work lightly. But I also don't think that that I'm any more special than anybody else. I think we all have our gifts and our talents, and you know, people that are in human services field or in service industry. The only thing different about me is I do it in front of thousands of people, but you know, it doesn't make you know me any more special than anyone else. I think it's important. As people to find your talents and to realize that, you know, we have maybe have several talents. When I worked with special needs kids, I never thought that I'd have a career as a performing artist. I was in the moment, and that, you know, as part of my gift is also working with special needs kids. So
people in your position are not known for having that sort of attitude toward other people very often. I mean, do you suffer from the perception that when you walk in the room, people assume that you're going to be very overbearing and sort of assume that you're the star in terms of the way you'll be treated?
A bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. In my hometown, which is about 100,000 people, you know, when I first moved back there, and you know, they realized that, you know, I'm an opera singer, and I really don't. I like to call myself a singer. You know, I sing opera, I sing classical music, but I don't like the term opera singer, so to speak, because I think it gives off a bit the wrong, persona. And they said, "But what do you really do for a living?" And I said, "No, this is what I do for a living. I make my living as a singer." So it was important for me when I moved back to my hometown to be involved in the community, to be involved in the arts, music education. It was through music education that I fell in love with opera. It was, my church organist in my hometown, you know, gave me free piano lessons. And so, you know, it was all these things that were given to me. So I think it's important for me as an artist to give back to the community and to give back to the arts.
Can I say something here?
Sure.
That I really feel very strongly about? And I felt that this was my mission as a composer who started a career, 56, almost 53 years ago in this business. That perception of the opera singer is strictly old-fashioned European. There are very few American opera singers of the last three generations for whom you could ever say that they're the typical, stereotypical
diva sort of.
Divas. Their own colleagues would just would let them know very soon, you know, come off it. Because American singers have really revolutionized opera, the opera world, since the Second World War. In a way that's been extraordinarily beneficial to opera and also to audiences. And the last thing I've found among opera singers is ego.
So that makes for better for performances if they don't walk in.
Oh, absolutely. And mm-hmm. I don't think – do you know of anybody who wouldn't just say get off it? You know?
Exactly. And the audience always knows if it's not If it's about you, it's
especially noticeable in American and English singers. And I've been with British singers in Europe, and they're just as down to earth and as very real about what they do as American singers, and also admire each other's work, and a lack of a sense of competition that I think you think of with the Collis and Tabaldi, that seems almost archaic now, you know, and I think it's been very healthy for opera.
Is there any difference in the amount of pleasure that either one of you derives from someone else's work if the performance is in another language? Do you prefer something in English, or does it not matter?
It doesn't matter to me. My career has been mainly a champion of American and English opera because it was my, you know, it was important for me as a young singer that people understood me. And when I was little and I'd have to sing in church, I'd have my little brother sit on the sofa, and if he couldn't understand a word, I'd make him raise his hand. So as an American singer, it was important for me for people to understand me when I sing in my own language. I think as American singers, we're, you know, trained to sing in all the languages, and we're expected to do them all very well. And so as Carlisle was saying, the stereotype of the, you know, the singer that comes in with the attitude and the, you know, the furs and the, all that is a bit archaic. I think, you know, today is, it's about, you know, collaboration and about reaching the audience and, you know, the audience reaching back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about. It's about communication.
And what about you in terms of language, Carlisle?
Well, it's very difficult to make a point about that. And when I started my career, there was a huge movement in this country to do opera, all opera in English. And St. Louis still does that, and Kansas City did it. But with the advent of surtitles, super titles that they're called some places, it really changed the face of opera.
This is
country.
The projection above the stage.
It totally changed the concept of what opera is. And it's demystified it as an art form totally. That's why we have such a huge increase in audiences in this country, which is not anything you can find, for instance, in the symphony world. But also the great proliferation of opera companies. When I started out, there were probably three or four companies at best, professional companies that could have launched a career. Now they're probably at least 25 or 30, I'd say,
yes.
20, that could command national attention. And there, in Opera America, the last count I knew that there were 130 companies. And so the opera world has changed, and a great deal of that has had to do with the advent of super titles. And so my feeling about it at first, the first time I ever heard an opera of mine was in Tulsa with super titles. And I didn't know how I'd react to it, but the point is that you realize the audience's participation is so much more intense. And what I think really is the crucial thing, that in Europe, in Germany, they did Susanna in English with German surtitles.
There you go. We're out of time now. Carlisle Floyd composed and wrote the libretto to Of Mice and Men. Tenor Anthony Dean Griffey takes the stage as Lenny on Sunday, June 8th. You can learn more at fwopera.org. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
By Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.